Unscripted.
Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We've got a lot to talk about. We're going to start with a couple of emails. Gabe, these two are related to an interview that you were not a part of. That boys between the ages of 3 and 10 give better directions than girls if they have a map.
If they have a map, somebody asks them, how do I get to there?
Yeah.
They can tell that person better than girls can.
Yes, they can. And I talked to Nardin Yacoub from New Jersey about why that's the case. The emails are about that. And one is from Elizabeth, who, it's a very long email. Thank you, Elizabeth, for sending such a detailed email. The gist of it is that I had kind of said, maybe there's a difference for me because I'm not good at directions. Maybe it's because I live in Germany and I'm less familiar with it. And she confirms that. She moved to Germany. And she basically talks about how in the U.S. all the streets are grid-like, and she can navigate those really well. And here in Germany, she is lost. It's a disaster. If you get on the Autobahn, I'm quoting the email, it doesn't even say which direction you're going, just to which city. And so if she wants to go west on the Autobahn, on the highway, first I need to know that Stuttgart is west of me. And even if I don't want to go to Stuttgart, normally and wouldn't even bother noticing west of Stuttgart, then you still have to know that.
And it sometimes mentions a city that's really, really far away. So if you have no knowledge of German geography, you have no idea where you're going.
Or where Luxembourg is.
You're on the A8 to Stuttgart. What if I don't know where that is?
Exactly. And then she flips. Her husband's German. And when he's in the U.S., he has a really difficult time. So probably cultural context, where you grew up is relevant. The other email, very interesting. I'll just summarize it here. This one from Charlie, retired archaeologist who listens to the show. He had a class of 22 students and six. They were men and women. Could not really understand the contours on a map.
3D map or what?
Yeah. You know when it shows elevation, gain, and drop?
Oh, topography.
Yes. Their brains couldn't do that.
Uh-huh.
He tried explaining it to them. They couldn't. And so I think his suggestion there
all,
is that...
All women or all
no,
men?
No, men and women. No difference in his little sample, his anecdote.
Okay.
The point being, there may be brain differences, clear brain differences in some people. Of 16 students, two were able to see a three-dimensional image of the map in their mind's eye. The others had no difficulty understanding the 3D information on the 2D map. Six of them, men and women, looked at this thing and they're just like, what are all these squiggly lines? I don't get that. Interesting anecdote.
But like magic eye, do you remember that?
Oh.
Some people could get magic eye, others couldn't.
You just crossed your
eyes. I couldn't do it.
Could you not?
No.
Oh, you missed a
to this day.
A fascinating world.
Destroyed my confidence, and here I am now sitting in the studio talking to you.
And there's an email that you have inside your head.
Michaela Kavanaugh.
Michaela is how you pronounce it.
Michaela Kavanaugh, a colleague, a DW colleague of ours.
I worked with her.
Was visiting family in Saskatchewan and met with her great aunt who lives in Winnipeg. Right? Obviously, that's not in Saskatchewan. It's in Manitoba. Anyways, let me get to the point. She said, I work for DW.
Our colleague did.
Yeah, Michaela.
Yeah.
And her great aunt said, oh, I know DW. I love that show, Science Unscripted, that comes on at 3 in the morning on the CBC. I wake up with the show and listen to it on headphones.
Yeah, she had, if I remember the email correctly, she has some sleeping issues, wakes up in the middle of the night, but tries to prime her subconscious.
Or is that how she does it?
Yeah, to wake up right at 3 a.m. That's when we're on the radio there.
Yeah.
So that she can hear us. I don't think your name was mentioned, or if it was, I've forgotten it. I'm sorry about that. I think you're about 70 years old.
Deanna.
Oh, Deanna.
Deanna or
Zana. Deanna.
Thank you, Deanna. If you're listening to this right now at 3 in the morning, I'm sorry that you're listening to this at 3 in the morning, but thank you. From the bottom of our proverbial heart here?
Yeah, for real.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah, this message is for you. On to the science.
Make this quick. We got to move.
We do. Okay. Are you familiar with the app Shazam, Gabe?
You play it and then you can hear exactly what song, or you know what song is playing. If you hear even three notes of a song, you play it and then you know.
Yeah, put the app on. I used it a couple weeks back.
Yeah.
I was getting a t-shirt and then the song was on and I opened this app and it recognized the song.
What was the song?
Mediterranee from Junior, if I'm saying it right. Like Junior with an E on the end.
You were down in Greece.
Mediterranee.
Right.
It's about the Mediterranean. I loved it. I still love it.
Sure.
So this app takes information from the real world and gives you information. Company called Osmo, based in New York, former Google researcher, wants the future to be the same to create the something like Shazam for smells.
Wow.
You're out somewhere.
What is that smell?
What is that smell? You open the app and your smartphone, in that case, tells you what that smell is.
Yeah.
Now, how would it do that? It would have to have a sensor reading all of these various molecules,
chemicals, yeah,
and chemicals. And this company, this startup, has used machine learning basically to say, look, if this molecule is in the air, humans call it this. It doesn't matter why we call it that. It could be meaty, it could be fruity, it could be a banana.
Lavender.
Could be barbecue smell, it could be toilet smell, it could be a rotten egg. That's what humans do. So they are trying to create a system where not just, it'd probably be computers at first, but then also smartphones can identify what's in the air.
My immediate and then thought, would it tell you the molecule or would it tell you the smell that
the
you
thing.
Think you
what
remember?
Is it? What is it? You're smelling the remnants of a charcoal barbecue. It depends how they program it. At the base level, kind of cool for people like this lady I stayed with in Austria who took us up into the Alpine Meadows and ended up with, she cried and said, I want to capture this smell as a perfume. And I was kind of trying to smell the air like, what is, how do you define all of these smells coming through the air right now? Yeah. That app would obviously help you to do that in connection with a perfumery. Yeah. What long term, why is it important? You and I have reported on medical breath analysis, the idea that we humans breathe out chemical compounds, volatile organic compounds. And then when we're sick, you can measure them. When we're stressed, you can measure that through human breath. Dogs can smell this with various forms of cancer. Mm-hmm. If they're smelling blood, they can, diabetes.
Our olfactory sense also wanes with time. So as we get older,
right,
it would be nice to know what we're smelling because we can kind of get it. But
yeah.
What is that again?
Then, so here's a wild future. The year is 2070 and you're sitting at your computer and the computer says, warning, warning, your stress is too high. Take a 5-minute break.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Now the dystopian version would be based on our readings. You're not working hard enough. Work harder. Mm. Right. But an interesting future to ponder and with big medical implications.
Speaking of smell, how about fruit flies and alcohol? Let's go to the University of Texas, El Paso. They wanted to answer the question, why when we drink with friends are we most of the time quite happy and effervescent? You drink alone,
ooh,
you're depressed.
Yeah.
What's going on there? They got a bunch of fruit flies drunk, some of them in a group, others alone. And they watched what these fruit flies did when they had this ethanol vapor exposed to them. The ones in the group, they moved around really fast. A lot of activity. Bouncing around. The ones that were alone.
Dance floor.
Did nothing.
They're on the fruit fly dance floor.
They did nothing. They were bouncing off. They were flying around.
And the ones who were solo.
Yeah. And the ones that were all alone had the ethanol vapor exposed to them. They didn't really do anything. Then they looked at what happens when you heighten dopamine with the fruit flies in the group, and alone, same thing. The ones that had this heightened dopamine went over the top, even more activity, faster. The ones alone did nothing. And then they checked on where in their fruit fly brain is this going on. It's the dopamine 1 receptor. In the human brain, that is the receptor that acts that with the biggest response to alcohol, and is also implied in alcohol abuse disorder. So now they're trying to answer this question: why, what's going on in the brain, or what part of the brain is responsible for our behavior when we're drinking with friends and alone? There is more dopamine firing when you are together with a group and exposed to ethanol than when you are alone.
Gotcha.
Alone.
Gotcha. And again, you've said this before on the show, one of the biggest conclusions, we talked about alcohol abuse and alcoholism in the past, and one of the best indicators that you may have problematic drinking is drinking alone. Mm-hmm.
That's Cornell University, absolutely
number one.
Convincing evidence. Don't do it.
Watch out for that. Homelessness, or being unhoused, not having a home, this is something that I think anecdotally for a lot of you out there, it feels like it's on the rise, partially because of, I don't know, prices going up everywhere, inflation.
Hard to get housing,
there's a shortage.
Less of it, more expensive.
I was convinced that that's objectively true. Homelessness is on the rise everywhere. I looked at OECD data, and it's not that clear cut. In the UK, homelessness has doubled since 2011. In the US, it's gone up in the last 5 years, but it's at about the same levels as right after the 2008 financial crisis. Mm-hmm. South Korea, it has dropped from 0.3% of the population down to 0.2% of the population. So it really depends where you are, and you can't cross compare because every country measures this differently. But some of you out there probably, again, anecdotally, also have this feeling that it seems more prevalent, or it seems like you're encountering it more often now.
We're going to speak in a bit with a researcher from Australia. She did a study on unhoused people and the police. But before we speak about these people, we needed to speak with them. And the closest ones are obviously the homeless here in Bonn. So the first guy we met, his name's Robin.
And I'm homeless since 6 months right now.
And how old are you, Robin? You don't seem like you're... Or you seem young.
Yeah, I know I look younger than I am. I am 25.
Do you get harassed by the police when you're here on the streets right now? You have a paper cup on the ground. People can put coins in it. Do you get harassed for that?
Actually, no. I never have been.
You've been out here for 6 months and you've never once been harassed by the police?
No, never. They came to me and asked what happened to me and how they maybe could help. So they sent me to some organizations which might could help me. So actually, yeah, I would say they helped me more than they harassed me.
Is this new to you? You said 6 months. Is this the first time you've lived like this?
Yeah, this is the first time. And yeah, I'm trying to get out of this fast as possible.
What were you doing before?
I'm not sure if it's called Undertaker. I buried people, actually. That's what I did for a living.
You were working as an undertaker before. Do you have a chance to go back to that job or one like it? Are you looking for something similar, or is it more about finding a place to live first?
It's kind of necessary to have a bed. I mean, address on your passport or something to find a job. Because when you apply for a job and you cannot give them an address, they know you're homeless, and then they probably won't take you, which is understandable, I think. Yeah.
That number I mentioned before, the huge jump in homelessness in Bonn, refers to the people without an apartment. And what he's speaking there about is how impossible for him it is to get an apartment right now.
Right. So that number includes people who are already housed publicly.
Yeah.
So it's
he's one of the between 80 and 100 who are sleeping on the street.
Right. And are in desperate need of housing.
Another one of them is Roddick. And this guy's interesting because he has a perspective that not many people do. He's been homeless in a lot of different countries all around Europe.
Whoa, I had many experience. I had a problem with the Guardia Civil. I had a problem with the D1 in France. I had a problem with the police in Poland. I had problems with the police, special force of police in Portugal. They beat me up for nothing.
What does that feel like when the police f*** with you?
It's a pain. It's a pain. And they take you down, and they beat you, and they kick you, and they drive on you. My God, it's horrible. Sometimes it's horrible.
And here, no problems, sir.
No. It's the most soft. That's. I have to admit that. Yeah, they quite lovely.
They're lovely.
They're lovely. Yeah, they are. I can't complain.
And you could probably hear there, Roddick had been drinking. I think we talked to him at about, I don't know what time that was, 11 in the morning. And I think he's been...
We're going to hear him on the guitar later. And he was apologizing for his playing, even though I thought it was unbelievably beautiful. Exquisitely beautiful, to borrow a line from Brent, one of our listeners. But he was apologizing that he was so drunk.
Yeah, and I guess what was interesting about talking to them, or something that we heard, we talked to a lot of different people. Not all of them wanted to be recorded, understandably, was that the common theme, there were some exceptions, but the common theme was that the police, at least in this one city, Bonn, Germany, are relatively friendly. And that's also the perception. I'm not trying to be biased. If it was the opposite, if they'd said the opposite, I would say that. Mm-hmm. But they were saying consistently, and Roddick there, who's been in all these EU countries without a home, was saying that they're lovely here. Yeah. It's not the case that the police are constantly, I don't know, harassing them, attacking them. Lovely is how he described it. And the others had similar things to say. They were mostly there to help. The study out of Australia, I think, is closer to what tends to happen more often elsewhere.
Yeah, it's the opposite, really. The people that were spoken to as part of this study came from all around Australia, all the major cities in Australia and some rural areas, and they spoke about a hyper-policing. That's actually the title of the study, and we're going to hear now about that and what it does to these people to be constantly harassed. From Talia Anthony.
Science Unscripted.
Hi, my name's Talia Anthony, and I'm a professor of law at the University of Technology, Sydney. I'm an expert in criminal law, especially as it relates to marginalised groups, and I just published a paper on the over-policing of homeless people on the streets.
And what was the conclusion of that paper, Talia?
So the conclusion of the paper was that people experiencing homelessness tend to fear the police as their primary safety concern. And of all the criminal justice interventions, whether it's courts or prisons, it was police that they felt had the most intervention in their lives.
How many unhoused people did you speak with for this paper?
So we spoke to over 160 unhoused people across the country. So we talked to people in all capital cities and also regional towns.
And what questions were you asking them?
We asked them about their interaction with all stages of the criminal justice system. So not only policing, but also whether they had gone to court, their experience with lawyers, whether they'd gone to prison, their experience with parole. So it was a fairly broad reach. But what they continuously wanted to speak about was policing.
One thing I have to clarify here, because I'm surprised at one thing you just said, which is that the police are the largest source of fear for unhoused people. My assumption from the outside would have been, well, what if I'm... I don't know, sleeping in an alleyway or sleeping outside and somebody else comes and attacks me. But was that part of the question as well? And were they really most fearful of the police?
So they absolutely did raise issues of violence by other people on the street, including unhoused people. But when they talked about their experiences of being harassed and direct violence, they most commonly regarded the police as the constant source of that threat. And I think that's because they had, you know, often daily interactions with the police. So they felt quite targeted by the police, whereas other acts of violence might be more incidental, whereas the police felt quite concerted.
And what did these 160 people have to say about the police? What was the common denominator when they were describing their relationship with law enforcement?
The common denominator was that the police were always in their lives, even if it wasn't for a coercive purpose. So they would come up to them, ask them how they're going, ask for their name, and it would often escalate into checking whether they had a warrant out on them. It can escalate into charges. But even where there weren't charges, they just felt that the police were too involved in their lives, and then that meant that they were not free on the streets. So what we commonly heard was them saying not that they wanted better policing, but that they just wanted the police to leave them alone.
So it's not necessarily violent attacks by police officers on them. It's the fact that they're just getting bothered. They're getting bugged. They're getting annoyed by police officers every day.
Absolutely, Connor. And it's a situation where, you know, it can be very low-level annoyance of just being asked all the time how they're going, you know, even in the same day being asked what their name is and having a warrant check. Or it could be really annoying things like they're sleeping, you know, finally found a safe place to sleep. They've got all their belongings. It's 2 a.m. The police get the torches out, flash it in their face, tell them to move on, you know, to a place outside of the CBD, kilometres away. And they have to do that, you know, at a time when they feel very vulnerable, where they're made to move to a place that's unfamiliar. And so that kind of activity can really play with their mental health, play with their sense of security as a homeless person, and I think ultimately make them feel continuously stigmatized, you know, that they're the problem, even though, you know, internally they're feeling like they have the problem of homelessness, but they're being positioned as the problem on the street.
Talia, you're a professor of law, so this maybe isn't your beat, but what did these 160 people have to say about that psychological effect? What is it doing to them to be constantly hounded, no matter whether they're breaking the rules or not, by the police?
They felt like they couldn't settle, so it would result in significant anxiety and a sense of, obviously there's placelessness physically, but a loss of identity internally, because before they were homeless, many of these people had jobs. They obviously had homes at some point. They had families. And so they have an identity that is not just about being unhoused, but the police make them feel like they are nothing more than a problem on the streets. And I think that really affects their confidence and their capacity to, you know, be empowered and deal with the crisis of homelessness that's confronting them, because they're pushed further into that crisis. I think the police have a role in moving on homeless people, where it does become, you know, the optics of homelessness becomes a problem for a suburb, especially more gentrified areas. And I also think it's a way in which people may perceive safety if there are police around, but it's certainly not a way in which homeless people perceive safety. So I would think for the public to be safe, it would be much better to house these people rather than to have police around these people.
And again, that was Thalia Anthony talking to us there. I believe we mispronounced her name throughout that interview. Apologies.
Called her Thalia.
Yeah, more closer to the German.
And there is science behind what she said there at the end. Housing first. There was a meta-analysis done on the science behind homelessness. How do you reduce it? If you want to reduce it, how do you do it?
Well, if there's one thing you can do.
Housing first. There was a 26 studies they were looking at, and they came to the conclusion that if you give permanent housing to a homeless person, it reduces it by 88% compared to what's known as treatment first, getting all their other issues set up or fixed first before you give them housing. No.
Well, that's logical enough, and I read that, and it confirmed what I guess I was biased to believe is true, but even though we had planned to kind of end this there, we thought, well, let's go check in with some of the some of the people or the organizations responsible for giving them housing in the first place and see if they also agree that that's the most important thing.
There is an initiative, what's called an offensive, the Bonn Offensive, to eradicate homelessness by 2030. And we spoke to one of the people working for that offensive, Helena Marks, and she said, it's important.
It's not the only thing.
But not at all the only thing.
If an unhoused person walks over here right now and they get a place to stay for months, is that the biggest change that you could possibly do to help somebody who's living that way, who's living on the streets?
Menschen, die von Wohnungslosigkeit betroffen sind, eine Wohnung zu geben, kann sehr viel.
Giving people who are homeless a place to live can make a huge difference. It makes them a part of society. But social support and healthcare is also needed. If that person has a psychiatric disorder, it's possible that they will lose the home they were given. It's true, housing is needed first and foremost, but we cannot forget the things that provide stability so that they can keep their home over the long term.
This has been a long report here about homelessness, or the science of what to do with unhoused people here in Bonn, and it makes it look like we want to paint Bonn in a really, really good light, but it wasn't. Not everyone we spoke to on the street was happy about the situation or what's being done for the unhoused people in Bonn. And the last guy we're going to hear from here is a guy named Snoopy.
That's how he called himself.
Yeah. Both legs amputated, open wounds. He's had a rough go of it.
It is so hard. Wie gesagt, am 23. Januar nächstes Jahr, also 2025, bin ich 20 Jahre im Bonner Loch. Nie war es so hart wie jetzt.
It is so hard.
Yeah.
On January 23rd, 2025, it will be 20 years for me living on the street in Bonn, and it's never been as hard as it is now. I can't park my wheelchair anywhere without the police or security telling me to move. People only have credit cards. They don't have spare change anymore. Even if they wanted to give, do you think I have a card reader? I don't even have a bank account. So I can't pay for anything. It's absolutely insane how hard it's become. And that word insane doesn't even do it justice. There's no word in the German language that could describe my life. And yes, I have tears in my eyes right now because it hurts to see this happen. I feel left alone. That's it. End of story.
Ja, und ich habe jetzt gerade Tränen in meinen Augen, weil es mir weh tut, das mit anzusehen. Ich fühle mich verlassen. Fertig. Punkt.
Yeah, and that brings us to the end of a a difficult topic to talk about, because I think a lot of us don't hear from people without a house very often, right? Is that part of it?
That was one of the things that Thalia said, that she wanted to give these people a voice by doing scientific work about them. But if it does nothing else, it gives you a different perspective on people you don't want to see. Who wants to see this? Almost, it's scary.
You also mean that in a positive way.
Yeah, of course. Of course, we want it to go away optically, but also
to be solved.
Yeah,
and it is complex, and it includes housing, and that's what needs to be built. A very difficult topic at a time where I think it is important to talk about it, because again, it feels somewhat anecdotally. It's also about how various media forms, media channels talk about the housing situation and unhoused people and which channels you listen to. But I think it's important to understand how they experience the world and how the police, which I, prior to this report, thought were like the solution, the ones helping the situation and making it all better, can also be the ones making it worse.
Yeah. Yeah, and with every complex situation, you're going to have different views, and I'm sure that you guys have them. So let us know where you stand on any of the issues that we spoke about today. SCU@dw.com.
Science Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.
I should have known I'm trunk.